I will take you with me during how do, what I want to do is tell you first a bit of the theory, which we probably already know, about how to deal with EU law in the national context. And I'm trying to find the next slide, so, yes. The first principle, of course, is a very important principle which we all know about, but which is on the basis of everything what we do as judges, and that's the principle of loyalty. And that's laid down in Article 4, Paragraph 3 of the Treaty on the European Union. It's if you read the article for the first time, you would get the impression it's basically for the member states, but by now we know it's also directed at us, as judges. We should also, as judges, make sure that everything we do is in the context of the European Union law. We will see more of that later on. So we also have to make sure that the obligations of the treaties have a good come out in our national law and in our day-to-day law practice. Since the Lisbon Treaty, we also have Article 47 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU, which is directed very much at us as judges. There is a right to an effective remedy and to a fair trial. It's also, of course, based on Article 6 of the European Human Rights Charter, but this is now also in the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU. And we will see later on that this made the role of the judge in the practice of European Union law more intense in all our countries and in a lot of fields. Not, of course, in every field, because the Charter only applies if it's connected to European Union law. So sometimes you do not apply it in your national cases, but sometimes you do. So the mantra which I always use when I'm teaching the students is the national judge is an EU judge. We are all EU judges. So that sounds easy. We have our scope. We have the principle of loyalty. We have our Article 47. That's the scope we have to deal with. It actually sounds very easy. We are an EU judge. We should deal with it. Shouldn't be too difficult, should it? But still it is. I didn't find this for nothing. It's why it's not easy is the importance of our own role. What do we do? The EU law is made in Brussels, as we say. You know, you're looking, I think, into what's happening day to day there. I'm curious, maybe we speak later. But it's influenced by all our countries. All the legislative history is coming from all our national parliaments, from all our governments. We are all national judges. In our training, we are schooled in our national law and trained in our own systems. And for most of us, I think, maybe for the younger ones, a little less, the EU law was a nice extra. When you were at university, it was an extra, but it's not so much integrated in how you think. You still think accordingly to how you have trained in your national law. So that makes it interesting to know how it works in all our different countries. One of the first things is, and I think that's one of the first difficulties we face, is to recognize the EU law. When are we dealing with EU law? Because when you're dealing with EU directives, it's usually, if it's done correctly, implemented in your own law. So you have to know, okay, I'm dealing with my own national law, but somewhere behind this, there's an EU directive. So the EU legislation has influence on what I'm doing. And it has especially influence when the implementation is maybe not completely correct. So that's an interesting question. And in daily practice, I will give you an example when we in the Netherlands were not very sure if we were dealing with EU law. The questions were coming up. A lot of you said where they were living from, and there was some tourists. I live in Amsterdam. My court is in Utrecht, but I live in Amsterdam, so you're all welcome, but maybe not all at the same time. Let's keep it at that. And when I was still a judge at the Amsterdam District Court, as you probably know, one of our main features in Amsterdam is the guided boat tours on the channels. It's one of the best features when you're a tourist in Amsterdam. You should all go because it's really beautiful to see the city from the water. It's one of our major tourist attractions. As you can imagine, it's also very interesting for people to start a boat company and try to get as many tourists as possible on the boat. There are a lot of companies that try to exploit boats to tour the tourists through the channels. But there are more companies who want to do that than the local government wants to have on the channels, because otherwise it will get too busy. The city of Amsterdam has been trying to regulate the market for years, but not to a great success. Every time they took a measure, the measure ended up in the court, and the court said, well, this is not a very correct measure, you should try again. So there was a huge caseload of coming of all those boat owners to the District Court of Amsterdam. A lot of procedures means a lot of lawyers, and one of them had an insight. And he stated that the Directive 2006/123 on service in the internal market applied to the case of the touring boats. And that's the directive on the services in the internal market, so that the services should be free and everybody should be able to provide a service. And everybody thought, well, it's in Amsterdam, it's only boats on the channel, it's not a very EU thing, it's an internal, it's a Dutch internal thing, it's not an internal market thing. We were not sure that that was correct, but still there was a little doubt because, as I told you, there are a lot of tourists on those boats, so you never know. Another thing, as you probably all know, Amsterdam is famous for but not so proud of, is the business of the prostitutes behind the windows. Together with this case about the boats, there was also a case about prostitution behind the windows, because also the government of Amsterdam tries to regulate that, because too many prostitutes behind windows is not what you want when the tourists come. You rather have them in boats. In that case, there was the same lawyer, same. He had the same arguments. Also, this directive should apply there. That case is within the scope of the directive. The Amsterdam District Court said, yeah, it might be in scope of the directive, but it doesn't apply. So they actually, it was rather smart. I didn't do it myself, but I thought it was a smart move. They tried to, as you can do it when you're a lower judge, they try to move it away, try to keep out of the basic discussion and think, I don't want to go there. But of course, the appeal court can't get off that easily. So they had to pose questions to the Court of Justice and to the EU court. And this resulted in a case in 2014. And they ruled that it was definitely not an exclusively internal situation, that the service of the boats may also be enjoyed by nationals of other member states, and that maybe one of the boat companies would also be operated from another country. Why not? Why couldn't somebody who has a lot of experience with tourists from Barcelona start a boat company in Amsterdam? Why not? So they said, no, that should be possible. So it's not purely an internal situation. And also in the prostitution case, they ruled that the clients and the providers of the services can be, and actually often are, national of other member states. So also there, it wasn't a purely internal situation. So that was an example which actually in the Netherlands quite surprised us. We didn't see this coming. And it had a huge impact on our day-to-day caseload, because every case we had to look back and think, oh, maybe this directive is also applicable here. So that was for us, it was a surprise. The question is, what do you do when you have recognized there is EU law, but you're wondering if your national law, when the directive is implemented in your national law, doesn't seem to be in accordance with your EU law? How do you operate then? There's a lot of questions coming there, but this is a question which you can have. And of course, all of us apply our EU law, or apply the EU law, through our national procedural law. That is the main The main rule, the national procedural law is leading, but the member states have the obligation to ensure judicial protection of the rights of individuals under EU law. So that means you have to apply it through your own law. But there are it doesn't always apply that way because you have two principles, and I've noted them both on the sheet. One is the principle of equivalence. That means that if your national law is better for the case, or is in similar cases your national law is better for the individual, then you should apply the same thing for the EU law. That's the principle of equivalence. And the principle of effectiveness, and that's a very interesting one, and I will read it to you, but somehow my iPad is not doing what I want and hasn't been doing that the whole day. That says that it can't make it near impossible. So you have to be able to put your EU law effectively into order, into your practice. And the criterion is that it can't be near impossible to get your rights under EU law. That's the principle of effectiveness. And I will come back to that later on. Because what do you do then? And what is interesting is this is an old theory. It's been from the beginning all on has the court held this theory consequently. But lately you see little cracks in this theory because sometimes now, especially under the influence of Article 47 of the Charter, you see that the court is saying no, but there should be a procedure here in national law. So you see a more procedural interference from union law than before. And when I read it correctly, and maybe you differ of opinion in this, but I think since the Charter has been in working, that there has been a slight shift in the way the court looks at cases like this. And I always thought this was a really nice way of treating it because you have a checklist and you do it and then you come somewhere. But lately I find it's not so easy anymore. As I said, the principle of effectiveness that they say it must not make it in practice impossible or excessively difficult to exercise rights conferred by EU law. And as the principle of equivalence, they say the rights under EU law must be no less favorable than those governing similar domestic actions. That was the time that was easy. But lately, as I said, this has changed a bit. And that I think that Article 47 has a major influence on that. And I will give you an example. There was a case in the Netherlands, an asylum case, and probably in your countries it's the same, but our government has a big backlog with treating asylum cases. So there are a lot of people waiting to have their case handled, and there's just nothing happening in the meantime. And before, our procedural law had an instrument that you could put a penalty on the government for every day they didn't decide. They had 6 months to decide, and every day they went over those 6 months, as a judge you could say, well, then you have to pay or decide. So that was an extra way to try to get the government to decide those cases, because if you're applying for asylum, it's important that you know quickly, because your life is on the line, and maybe your family is still in the country you came from, and you're nervous about it. So there's a good reason that from all human rights perspective, everybody says those cases shouldn't be let lie too long. They should be treated a bit swiftly. But that didn't happen. And because of the, it was getting quite expensive for the government because they got those penalties all the time. So then they thought, let's try and move faster on those cases. They thought, let's change the law. So they changed the law and they say, okay, you still can apply for a quicker quicker treatment of your case, but you can't get a judge cannot put a penalty on the government anymore. And of course, that came before a court as a case, and then the court says, and this has not been, I think, maybe Hilda knows better, but I think it hasn't been treated in appeal yet, this case. But the court said, of course, you should still treat those cases quickly. And this penalty law is not wrong if you look at it from this way. It's not wrong from the principle of equivalence, because it's a different kind of case. You have immigration case and you have other cases, so there's nothing which is a little bit similar. And it's not wrong from the principle of effectiveness if you wonder if it's not made nearly impossible to get your case before the court, because you can still ask the court to put a ruling on the tempo or the quickness of the decision. Only you do not get a penalty, but that doesn't breach the principle of effectiveness. But then they turned to Article 47 of the Charter, and they said, but if you look at in the light of Article 47 of the Charter, that gives more light to the effectiveness of the procedure. And then they said it doesn't seems to be okay in the light of 47 of the Charter, because then the scrutiny about what is effective, what is an effective remedy, is far more stronger than the scrutiny under this question. So then you see the difference that Article 47 is, at least in our country, and I have seen more cases when 47 of the Charter is giving more a new meaning to the word effective remedy and effectiveness of the EU law in your national practice. So for me, this is an interesting question also to see how it will move on, because this makes the system of the procedural law and your EU law, it changes it a bit, it tweaks it. Another case is also an immigration case, it's a Dublin case, where even the EU court said the Netherlands didn't have a procedure for a certain kind of asylum cases when there was the Dublin regulation was on the line. And then the EU court said in a case, you should have a procedure for this. So where the Dutch law didn't have an exact procedure in its own national law, the EU court said you should have a procedure in cases like this. So that went one step further. If you are dealing with EU law, there's always a question of what am I reading? If your own law is not completely in accordance with EU law, or if you're wondering about it, one of the first questions you have to ask yourself is, do I understand? What am I reading? And then you come to the interpretation methods. And that's when you're wondering, can I explain what I'm reading here in this directive or in this regulation? And usually you turn to the basic text, so to the EU text, when you're wondering about your own law. You're applying your own law and you're wondering, what am I reading? So you turn to the text that's from the EU regulation, and you read that, and then sometimes it's immediately clear, because then you just have to question, what do I do with my national law? I'll come to that later. Sometimes you still wonder what am I reading in this directive or in this regulation. The court in Luxembourg has given a lot of solutions about this, and they, of course, the first logical one is to compare the text in different languages, because we have all the 27 languages are equal, so you can compare the text in the languages you know and see if that makes a difference in your understanding. The most important, I think, interpretation method is to interpret the directive in the light of the wording and the purpose of the directive. I will show you more about that later on. And in the light of that, it is again effectiveness of the directive. So you look at what is the purpose, and then is this effective? So that means that when there's an exception in a directive, then the exception shouldn't be made too big. That should be kept small, because you look at the purpose. So the purpose is a very important thing when you're trying to explain what you are seeing. And you can sometimes find the purpose in the meaning, in the recitals. Before the articles start in a directive, you usually have the recitals. There you can find what was the meaning of the legislator. What did they mean? Why did they make this directive? What was the importance behind the directive? You can find that in the recitals, and that gives a lot of insight. Usually, I used to tell the students that the legislative history is not so important. I don't know how it is in your countries, but in our country, it is the first thing you look at when you're trying to explain a national law. You look at the legislative history. You see what happened in the whole history, and what did government mean when they made this law, and that's your first source when you try to explain your national law. And I used to teach my students that in European law, legislative history is not so important. But lately, I've seen a couple of cases where you see the court ruling differently. That they look at the legislative history of the provision, and they look at the discussions that were had, and that they say, well, this is obviously meant for this. So you see that is changing a bit. Another thing which is important when you try to explain texts from EU law is if you're dealing with something that you have to, like a term that's basically an EU term, like asylum seeker. We all, in all our countries, we should treat that the same way. So you have to look at the wording and say, is this an EU term? Is this strictly something that you... Is EU wording? Should this be treated the same in all our countries, or is it something that you can interpret in your own language? It's just a normal word. Is it the regular thing that you're trying to explain, like employee, or is employee? Do you have to? Is that an autonomous concept of EU law that should be explained in the same way in all our countries? I think employees is an example which. Basically, the court has ruled over a lot of times. What do we mean by the term? Well, if you find out what is meant by the directive, then it's the next step is to check if your national law is not. If you're wondering if your national law is conclusive with the international law, with the EU law, you have to interpret it in conformity with the community law. The union law actually should be standing there. That's also very old jurisprudence from the court. And is this difficult to do this? Well, people differ, but actually it is not. It is not difficult. So this is the good news today. To do this is not so difficult. Our own lawyer, our own judge in the EU court in Luxembourg, Sasha Prechal, she says, well, short of interpreting a yes as a no, you're quite anything goes. This is of course a bit jokingly, but actually you can go quite far and you can be quite creative in trying to interpreted your national law in conformity with EU law. I find, and I think maybe you recognize this, that a lot of national judges find this difficult, because you try to think from, you look up from your own national law, you look up to the EU law, but actually you should try to do the exactly opposite and try to look through the EU law and then down to your own law and then think, I should make sure this is the same. And, well, as I say, people find it difficult, but my experience is if you look at all the cases where it happens, it's actually not that difficult to do. Of course, what makes it difficult is that we do not actually see each other's practices, because what the court usually does is says the national law should be interpreted in conformity with union law, and it is for the national court to decide if this is possible. So we only see our own cases. We see the cases in the Netherlands, you see your cases. So that makes it more difficult to find a sort of general feeling for it. But if you ask the judges of the court here in Luxembourg, they all say, well, yeah, no, you shouldn't be too... you should be brave and try it. Just do it. I think I'm running out of time, so I'll give a quick example of this, just to let you know. This is the Directive of Sanctions and Measures Against Employers of Illegal Staying Workers. So if there are illegal staying workers, non-EU nationals are working, you have a sanction system in the Netherlands. And in the directive, it says that the employer should check of the worker if his papers are in order, if he has a valid passport and a valid resident permit. And the Dutch law was quite strict, and it was almost as if the employer had to be a kind of a policeman and know all the falsifications of the passports and all the possible problems you can have with residence permits. And it seemed that the directive was a little more lenient to the employer and said, of course, you have to do a reasonable check, but you're not the police. So if the resident permit looks more or less okay, then you still have a problem, but you do not get a sanction anymore. You do not get a penalty. Our court said you have to, the Dutch law is too strict, you have to be a little bit more lenient. It didn't matter for the outcome of the case, because everybody who looked at the passport and the residence permit this person had shown to his employer could see it was somebody else. So that wasn't, for the question itself, it didn't really matter. Then, as important in the explanation and is the timing, this what I just told you only goes when a directive is transposed, and when a directive is not transposed or too late, then in the meantime you have also to the general obligation as a court to interpret your domestic law in conformity with the directive. When the period of transposition has expired. It's also old case law. Let me see. There's also, of course, you cannot do it, and that's when it's not possible, you cannot do it contra legem. You cannot do it, you can't make a yes or a no. That's basically what this says. So what do you do if it's really, you cannot interpret it? You have to disregard the conflicting national provision. That's your ultimum remedium. That's what you do if there's no other possibility. And also, actually, this happens quite a lot. So this is, I don't know how it is in your countries, but I have seen quite a few examples. And you see it also in the rulings of the court, because when the court rules this is really not possible, then they say, yeah, then you should disregard the conflicting national provision. So there are quite a lot of examples for this. And somehow, sometimes it seems that we find this easier than being brave and trying to bring it together. And actually, that may be, when you go back to what I told you in the beginning, the principle of loyalty, you should maybe always try first to put it in conformity. So this is a step-by-step approach. Is the national law in accordance with the directive? Is it transposed, and is it transposed in time? Can you interpret it in conformity with the EU law? And is the article of the directive unconditional and sufficiently precise? Because you can only it can only give rights to individuals if you know what it says, if it's unconditional and sufficiently precise. When in doubt, there's always the possibility to request a preliminary ruling. Well, we've heard sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And there's time for discussion.